Hello and welcome to Time with Pastor Otabel, our interactive discussion program that brings the power of scripture to bear on the biggest issues of our lives. My name is Albert Okran, welcoming you on behalf of Dr. and Mrs. Otabel. So we began this very interesting journey talking about relationships, and there is so much more we want to explore. And leading the discussion today is my joy to welcome, as always, Pastor Mensah Otabel. Doc, good to see you.
Good to see you too, and in your mask.
There is so much about relationships people want to learn, and I'm excited about the response to the discussions.
Thank you.
Let me welcome my colleagues, Pastor Kuja Mwasari. Pastor Kuja, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
And Pastor Priscilla Nananket. Yeah, Pastor Priscilla.
Thank you so much.
You're cruising.
I am.
Doc, let's focus a bit on premarital relationships today. And from the scriptures, it would look like Abraham, Isaac meticulously got involved in the selection of partners for their sons or their children. What is the role of parents today in the selection process for the children, the wives or spouses of their children?
Well, until recently, marriage was not a personal choice. In almost all cultures, it was arranged by families. And that has been so till very, very recently in the last century, that the notion that individuals should make their own choice gained root. Because traditionally, throughout human history, marriage was seen as the joining of families together. And sometimes it was for political reasons, sometimes for economic reasons. But families got involved to contract marriages on behalf of their children. In recent times, we've moved more and more to the parties themselves, the children or the parties of the marriage, making the decision. Which is better is up for debate, whether it should be families deciding for the children or children deciding for themselves. But the reality we have now is that more and more the people who want to marry make the choice themselves. Our parents then can offer some guidance, some advice. But beyond that, it seems our world is at a point where those who are going to marry make the decision.
Doc, you are a parent and a grandparent, so obviously very experienced. By virtue of how high you stand, your elevation gives you a further perspective than the person about to start. How do we deal with the tensions that often arise between the individual choice of the young people and the experience or the guidance of the parents, especially when they clash?
From a personal point of view, I've never had any problems with that. We raised our children to be responsible, to make good choices, and guided them on how to make good choices right from when they were young. And of course, when they tell us or they told us this is the person we wanted to marry, we grilled them with all the questions. Just to be sure that they knew what they were doing and had considered all the options available to them. But the choice is always theirs, and we respect their choices and the people they choose to live their lives with. So I think, families are very different. There are families where the parents more or less get very directly involved in the choices of their children, even to adulthood, and feel very, very responsible for their children, even when the children have grown and have to be responsible for themselves. I can understand, because a parent mostly has better hindsight and can see danger where children don't see danger, and as a result feel that because of what they see, their perspective should become the predominant one. Many times it becomes very conflicting with the children. I think in the end, we just have to trust that our children are good enough to make their own decisions, and that we support them and stand with them and pray with them and encourage them that those decisions turn out right.
Doc, what would be your counsel to somebody who loves, you've met somebody you love, and your parents say no, and they are not budging? What would be your counsel to somebody facing that kind of situation about how to
This would require individual counseling. I wouldn't want to make a public statement on it because, you know, the factors may be very different in each case. But it takes a lot of counseling, and I think children should not easily dismiss their parents' point of view and their decisions. They've gone through this journey before, and even if they have failed, they have learned a lot from their failure. And so their views should not be lightly thrown away. But I also think parents should also trust the decisions of their children and not try to overrule everything that they come up with. At the end, it's going to be mutual respect from parents and children to resolve what outstanding issues may remain.
I love the mutual respect. Pastor Priscilla?
Doc, sometimes an individual may have a number of prospective or potential suitors. And there are different tensions that arise as a result of this. How should a person manage these different friendships before deciding on one?
Generally speaking, I mean, when people are at the friendship stage of their lives, they have a lot of friends. And that would not be a committed relationship. Once a commitment comes, you can't have many. And a commitment comes when somebody says, I want to go out with you, and you say, yes, I want to go out with you. At that time, the two of you are beginning to take each other seriously. And you cannot be very liberal with that decision and have the same relationship with about three different people. But when there is no commitment and you're just normal men and women who are minding your own business, if you're a man, you have a lot of female friends. If you're a female, you have a lot of men friends. And you look through them, you pray about them, you consider them. And at that stage, you know, because there is no commitment, character traits come through very easily. You know people for who they are. Most of the people you know very well, you knew them when you were very young, probably when you were in school together, in secondary school or university, because your behavior was unfiltered. What you saw was what you got. So at that stage, you can make the best decision as to who is best suited for you. But once you settle, then you have to be committed and nurture that relationship to see whether there is hope for a marriage in it.
Doc, on the flip side, there may not be many suitors, but there may be a particular person who's been with you for a long time, implying everything, but saying nothing. How do you handle that?
That is from a woman's point of view.
From a woman's point of view.
So generally, people have different decision-making processes. And from a man's point of view, nobody likes to be shamed. And so you don't want to take it upon yourself to assume that the lady is going to be positive about your overtures. So some men want to be extremely careful and very, very sure that if they make the move, they won't be rebuffed. And that will keep them hedging for a very long time, even when the woman thinks she's giving all the indication that she's in this together. But because of dignity and personal dignity and self-respect, it's not easy for you to tell a woman you love her and for her to say, nope. I mean, that can ruin your self-esteem for a while. And so people take their time to do this. And I think when a relationship grows to a point where it is indicating clearly, it's easier for both parties to accept the reality that this relationship can become a marriageable one. Sometimes people make the indication too early and get rebuffed. And sometimes the ladies also take time to make their decisions. And so when a man thinks a woman has decided, she hasn't, she's still processing. So I think patience is required on both ends.
Thank you.
Yeah, Dr. Basho, the woman gives some green lights.
I wonder what the green light is. I think when you are interested in somebody, there is no need pretending you're not interested in the person. I mean, this is not a military strategy. We're not trying to conquer a nation. So, I mean, if you like the man, don't say I like you, but everything you say and do should send a signal that you like the person. You prefer their company to other people's company. Because as a relationship grows, you just realize you spend more time with one particular person than others. And that should begin to send a signal, I'm beginning to settle my mind about this person. If the person is interested, they will pick up the signals. If they're not picking the signals with all the efforts, two things may be at play. Maybe they're just friends, nice, good friends, but have no romantic interest in the relationship. They just want to keep it as a friendship. Or they are so intimidated by you that they need encouragement to state their minds from the position of a female and a male.
Doc, maybe the lady could drop a hint, like John the Baptist asks, are you he or should I expect someone?
Are you he who is to come or should I expect someone? I mean, if you're a bold woman, not every woman can ask that question. Some women are also quite protective of their dignity and their self-worth and don't want to appear too eager and to be rebuffed. No human being likes to be rebuffed. Nobody likes to be rejected. And so a very courageous woman can say that. Sometimes people may tell other friends to find out what is he thinking or what is she thinking. In private, when you converse, what are they saying? So it's just having clarity that this is this relationship. If you are bold and you don't care being rejected, then I think you can just be forward and say, are you the one or we should look for another one? But if you are one of those very demure ladies, then that's going to be a difficult push for you.
Doc, it seems from scriptures that in the olden days, people went straight into marriage, judging from the few recorded instances. What is scriptural position of dating and courtship?
Because of the way marriages were contracted, for example, in the Jewish society, there were processes. I mean, you would go and see the parents. Even if you saw the lady yourself, your parents would have to be the ones who would make the approach. If they accepted, then they would start the betrothal process, which is almost like marriage, but it takes about a year where the man then is preparing his home and all of that to receive his wife. So at that time, there is no intimacy between them, but there is a sense that they are going to get married. That is the best of what you call a dating period in those days. But this time, dating has a very wide understanding. From how people seeing it as a time to getting to know each other from a non-intimacy relationship to others who think that there should be intimacy. For a Christian, the only time there is physical intimacy between a man and a woman is when they're married. That's the only time. And every other period before then, there is no intimacy, and there is no pseudo intimacy. That means you cannot have other forms of intimacy and say, well, we didn't have sexual intercourse, so that is fine. No, you have to build the relationship as a non-sexual relationship until the marriage bed is sanctified.
Doc, could there be a good marriage without dating and courtship?
Throughout human history, that is how it's been. I mean, it's just in recent times that human culture is accommodating cohabitation and all of that. But throughout human history, in almost all cultures, marriage was the only time when there was sexual intercourse. So it means that we've lived with that culture tradition for years, and our bodies are used to it. So it's when we think that our time is the best time, and the permissiveness of our day is supposed to be the standard. But in all the periods of human history, that is not how it's been. People waited to marriage to have intimacy. So yes, yeah, marriages work, and if you look at it, even not too long ago, I know personally from my own family history that my grandparents married literally not knowing each other. My parents married through introduction. I don't think there was much of a courtship. I didn't go through their way. But what I'm saying is marriages worked, you know, for years without all the connotations of dating as we understand it now.
This is time with Pastor Otabo. Interesting discussion about relationships with a focus on premarital relationships. We'll go for a brief break. When we come back, let's ask that very big question that is on the minds of many of you. Don't go away, please. Welcome back to Time with Pastor Otabo, discussing today premarital relationships. Doc, let's go to that big question, love at first sight. So people meet somebody and they tell you they met the person last week or yesterday and they say they love them and they want to marry them. What would you say to that?
It's possible to meet somebody and be very certain that this is the person you want to live the rest of your life with. And it could come from different centers of your life. It could be a spiritual recognition where you might have spent time praying and thinking through whom you want to marry and being spiritually sensitive to it. So you may meet somebody and instantly have a spiritual knowing that this is the person. It may not be a physical attraction, it's just a spiritual knowing that this is the person. So that's one way it can happen. It could also be that you are so clear about certain qualities in your mind that have always informed whom you want to be your partner. And then you meet somebody and they exhibit that. And it could just be that they exhibited it unknowingly, but instantly you just knew this is it. So you had a precondition, and it's met by the other person. Many times it will be mutual, and that's where people call it love at first sight, where both of you meet for the first time, and you just get to know that. Some people call it chemistry. You have a chemistry about it. I think it is not necessarily chemistry or chemical. In that sense, but it is because in your mind, you've already settled the ideals you're looking for. And then you meet somebody who had also settled the ideals, and by some arrangement, what you both expect in each other is about the same. And the criteria is met. And that would be what they call love at first sight.
Will connection be a better word than chemistry?
You make some kind of connection or recognition of each other that is real. Then there are those who for whom it's purely physical, and then it may then be that they are in a physical state at a certain point where they meet somebody and it works.
I hear that for many people, they end up marrying somebody who, in a way, reminds them of a parent that they look up to. Is it true?
I think you may find out why you were attracted the first time later on.
Okay.
So later on, as you think it through, then you may find the attraction and where it came from. It could be from your liking of a parent or a sibling or sometimes a movie star, you know, something you liked that unconsciously that person reflected. And so right there, you knew that this was the person.
I like that.
Doc, a lot of emphasis is placed on personality types and compatibility. How much weight should two people who agree to work together place on their personalities?
My point of view is that for a marriage to work, the people must be respectful of each other. That's probably the most important foundation. They must be respectful of each other, and they must think selflessly concerning each other. If they have this too, no matter the temperament, tribe, whatever, the marriage will work. If these two are lacking, you can have all the chemistry you want, you're going to have some serious struggles, because these are the two important glues that hold a relationship for a very long time. There has to be mutual respect, and there has to be a giving of each other's self to the other person, prioritizing the other person, and giving selflessly to the other person. I think so many things can be worked through if the fundamentals are right. And I wouldn't want somebody to say, I'm not going to marry this person because our temperaments are too different. That's why you should probably explore the person, because you're very different from them. Even where your values are very different in terms of family values, how you were raised up and socialized in your families are very different, you can still work it out. Even if there's a huge educational gap, you can work it out. There's a huge social gap. One is very rich, the other is very poor. It can still be worked out if they respect each other and are willing to give of themselves to each other. They can work out whatever is there. So I wouldn't really place too much emphasis on temperament. It's important. Sometimes you need to do the temperamental assessments to know who you are, not so that you decide whom you should marry, but so you understand your partner a little better and know how to relate better with them.
Mutual respect is the key.
It's the foundation. It's the most important. And I think that is why, in the time past, marriages worked, even though there was no dating, there was no courtship, and there was no chemistry and love at first sight. Most times you met the person you're going to marry, and then you married. But there was respect. Respect for each other. The husbands respected, or the men respected their women. They call it chivalry. And men were trained to respect women and to take care of them and give them the chair when they have to sit down and open the door for them and speak to them nicely and gently and kindly. And women were taught the same about men. So the whole culture of respect is what kept those marriages. Unfortunately, the culture of respect has been lost.
Now, could you say that the loss of that is having an effect on marital longevity these days?
I think it's the most critical factor for marital failures this time. The lack of respect for each other. Men don't respect women. Women don't respect men. Most men see the women only from a sexual point of view. and sexual satisfaction. The women probably also see that way. And there's no respect for the person that and there's no courtesy towards the person, no kindness towards the person, no gentleness towards the person, no valuing of the person. And if you don't do that, marriage is not going to work. It's not going to work. You may be temperamentally aligned, but you're going to have difficulty because marriage is built on respect. Mutual respect and very deep respect that is reflected in our actions one towards the other.
Beautiful.
Doc, so after respect and selflessness, can love take a third place in terms of priorities?
Respect is a form of love. You know, selflessness is a form of love. Love has different forms. But I pick respect because it's a form of love that deals with the value of a human being, the center of a person, human dignity. Because, you know, everything physical can be lost. But when you have real respect, you can stay with a marriage and a person over a very long time. So, and so, yes, it's a form of love. Selflessness is a form of love. Attraction is a form of love too, but I think that form is not as valuable as we think it is. The respect and selflessness are the most important.
Doc, would you recommend full disclosure and openness of one's past at the teething stage of a relationship?
It's a very, very dicey situation because different people handle things differently. But it comes to my fundamental, if you respect each other, then you can respect their story. You don't dishonor their story, and you don't honor their history. Everybody has history. Everybody has been somewhere before. People have dramatic history. Others have less dramatic history, but everybody has some history. And the people we are married to are not the first people we related to. And some people's history can be very painful. And I feel that if somebody has had a very painful history and they have the courage to share it, that courage must be respected. And that history must be respected. Where there is no respect, the history will be abused. And it will be dishonored. And so what you shared, which you thought would bring understanding, will bring misunderstanding. And it's all because of what I call the respect value. So I wouldn't, these are some of the things I don't want to say do or don't on TV. I think it's important to counsel people individually. On these matters, because I don't want somebody listening to me to say, well, then I'm going to say what happened to me in secondary school. It may ruin the relationship. It has to be done advisedly.
I think that for many people, the fear is that when it is found out later, trust would be seen to be breached. And that is most people's fear.
I mean, if something has happened, and I'm not saying don't say it. I'm just saying that if the relationship is problematic right from the beginning, saying it is going to ruin the relationship because there's no respect and there is no sensitivity and there is no value for human dignity in the relationship. So whatever you say will be used against you. So if there is something in your histories that is public knowledge that would definitely come out. A schoolmate will say it. A friend will say it. I mean, it's going to come out whether you like it or not. Then it's better you find the best way to communicate that. If it is something that may never come out, but still makes you feel that you're holding against something against the other person, then you have to find the best way to communicate it. Because that is one way where ignorance may sometimes be a blessing, but It may be a blessing in the not fully, because you don't feel good about it. You feel that the other person should share that part of your story with you. It has to be done advisedly.
Doc, you mentioned problematic relationships. There are times when every indication shows that a relationship is struggling. Do you fight to salvage it? And at what point do you say, you know what, this thing is really not working?
I think it's better to break up a relationship before marriage than after marriage. So you have to count the effect. Splitting something at this early stage or splitting it later. The most marriages that do not work, the seeds of it were observed before the marriage started. It's just that, like human beings, we all feel it can get better, we can work on it, and then it gets very bad. But that is not also to say every struggling relationship should be abandoned. Sometimes struggle is based on, it's just ignorance, some information, some counseling, some help can give you the tools to resolve the struggle. But if it is violence, it's not workable. If there's physical violence, it's not workable. If there is substantial abuse, verbal abuse, insults, gross disrespect, it can be worked through. It cannot. If there is substance abuse, severe drunkenness and things of that nature, drugs, you have to resolve this very quickly because it's going to get worse. Let people sort out their problems for a future partner. But I think you should find a way to end the relationship.
The word end is hard for many people. But last week, in a previous edition, you made a very profound statement that people don't fundamentally change. I'd like to stay with that a minute or two.
Yes, because most people are stuck with who they are. They can change, but the price for change may not be something they are ready for. Because, you know, the reason people don't change is because they defend their weaknesses. They accept it as part of their package. They don't see it as an abnormality with them. So they will say, that's how I am. That's who I am. If you don't like me, that's how I am. And because people have accepted their weaknesses as an integral part of themselves, they can't change it.
So that means that
you can only change when you recognize your weakness as a weakness and make the efforts to deal with them.
So fundamentally, if there's something that is repeatedly happening in courtship and you see it and it's not dealt with, don't enter marriage hoping that by some miracle it will change.
Oh, marriage actually may exaggerate the problem. It may make it worse because of the component of familiarity that comes with marriage, because you stay with the person and you become used to the person. And if you didn't resolve the problem before marriage, it's going to be difficult to resolve it within marriage.
It's a bit of false hope in that regard.
I think we're all hopeful that people will change and things will get better. And they do get better with proper guidance and counseling. But some issues are not counselable. Violence is not open to counseling. If a man hits you before you marry, it's not a counseling issue.
And the selfishness?
Selfishness, if there's gross selfishness, this person is the center of his life is himself. Spends all his time on himself, all his money on himself, all her money on herself, all her time on herself. Every argument has to be won by him or her. They don't care about your feelings. They don't care about your emotions. They don't know how to say sorry. They don't know how to apologize. They don't know how to make peace. And you're seeing it before marriage. Commonsensically, you should advise yourself.
I love this. What's Priscilla?
Doc, when relationships break down, sometimes people find it very difficult to move on, because they've invested time, they've invested emotions and other resources. How do they heal? How do they recover to move on?
It's a tough one, because you don't we get into relationships with our emotions, and we psychologically get involved in with a person, and they become an important part of you, and you invest a lot of your feeling and your thoughts in them. So once that breaks, it's always a very, very difficult phase for anybody. Sometimes people feel that the way to respond to it is to get a replacement. That's not the way to do it. You must take some time off to sort yourself out. And I always advise counseling. That you go through some form of counseling just to help you to position what has happened, come to terms with it emotionally, pray about it, seek God's face about it. And at a certain time, maybe 3 months, 6 months down the line, a year down the line, depending on the severity of it, you'll find yourself feeling well emotionally to commit to another person without being suspicious of that other person unnecessarily. So how long does it take? Nobody knows. It depends on the severity of your feeling and what you're going through.
You know, Doc, these days people are really investing, paying school fees, paying rent, buying clothes. So they are really hit hard.
Yes, I think people invest too much into relationships. And I feel that's the wisdom also of the Bible. That says that there has to be a separation before you come together. You must live your individual lives. I mean, if you feel like helping somebody, it has to be very token help. Because if you overcommit, then even when the thing is not working, because of the extent of commitment, you may push it. And then 6 months after the marriage, they want out, you know. And everybody who 6 months after marriage wants out saw the problem way before the marriage, but because they had overcommitted. And sometimes they are overcommitted sexually. Sometimes they are overcommitted emotionally, financially. They just feel they have to go ahead. And then 6 months later, they don't want to go at it again.
This is time with Pastor Otable. Beautiful answers to the questions and more questions arising. When we come back, we'll explore some very thorny issues that we talk about, but we don't have answers to. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Time with Pastor Otable, and aren't we having fun discussing the issue of premarital relationships? If you love somebody, if you care about somebody, send them the link, call them to watch us, and let's explore these very important life themes. The number on the screen is the number to send your question to, and send as many as you can with your name and your location so we can ask Pastor Otable in subsequent editions. Pastor Koyu?
Doc. Considering the fact that courtship does not automatically end up in marriage, how does one guard against his emotions so that he doesn't get overly attached and committed?
We cannot be cynical where you're courting, but you're also anticipating it will not work, so you don't give of your heart and you don't give of yourself to it. I mean, you have to give your heart to it. And that's the risk you are taking. It may not work, but you have to give it your best effort. So I think there has to be real intention to make it work. You have to invest emotionally. When there are problems, you have to make time to sit and talk it through and resolve them. You have to invest into forgiving each other and giving each other, you know, the opportunity to be better. These are things you have to do genuinely. And I feel that if we invest properly, hopefully it works. But if it doesn't, you will not blame yourself that you didn't give it your all. You gave it your all, and for some reason, whatever reason, it didn't work. So love is very risky. Relationships are very risky. Risky in the sense that they don't always turn out the way you want them to turn out. But it's a risk worth taking, and it's an adventure worth going on. And give it your best goodwill and your best intention.
Doc, talking about risk and adventure, sometimes the literature, the movies paint a picture about relationships that is not realistic. And so people get disappointed when the reality doesn't match what they saw in movies or read in books. How do we create the proper balance in expectation?
Well, I think the best way is to look at the lives of those who make the movies and see whether they're managing it well. I know find most of them are struggling with it. So it just tells you it's a movie and you don't make it your priority. People who write romantic novels, you may find that in their own private lives are very, very disturbed people. We don't live our lives on fantasies. We live our life in reality. And the reality is the person in front of you, not the person you wish will be in front of you, but the person in front of you, the person you are in the relationship with. That's your reality. And don't hope that he or she would be somebody else. They are who they are, and you have to respect them for who they are. Learning to respect people is an effort. And it's something you have to really give yourself to show respect to people, to their time, to everything about them. So if you respect him or her, you will not fantasize about somebody else whilst you are in a relationship with them.
That means that ahead of the relationship to perception about how a relationship should be, it should not be informed by films and books.
It may give you a certain sense and a certain expectation. You can't run away from it. If you read some books, watch movies, it may give you an expectation. And that's why I said, just look at the lives of those who acted those movies. And then you know that that expectation is a totally unrealistic expectation. It is very unfair to expect that the life you have with somebody should be like a two-hour movie where all the problems are edited out and it's scripted for it to look nice. And you live with this person whose life has not been edited out and all his problems are there and there's no script. He's just living it or she's living it as it comes. I think it's very unfair to expect that it would be like a movie. So we can love movies, but they are never reality. And we have to deal with the reality of the person in front of you.
Which has no editing.
No editing.
I love that.
Doc, let's talk about blood covenants. Sometimes people enter into blood covenants supposedly to ensure their relationship from collapsing. What are your thoughts on this practice or any other premarital covenant?
I would consider that a mark of insecurity. And anything you do out of insecurity has no foundation. You know, whether you want the person to swear or write a note or give an undertaking or sign a document or join your blood together, it's all because you don't trust each other. And you want to control each other and manipulate each other. Because a relationship can be self or co-manipulative, where both parties are manipulating each other for their own good. And that's not what love is. That's not what respect is. If you respect somebody, you give them the freedom to arrive at their own conviction at the right time. And that's what respect is. You don't coerce them. You don't force them. So I don't see that as Christianity. Jesus said our yes should be yes and our no should be no. No, I swear this, I swear my mother's grave, I swear on whatever. Or let's go to the cemetery and make this incantation or promise at the cemetery or let's join our blood together. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I love you as I love you. I don't love you as I don't love you. anything more than that, Jesus says, is a sin. So all of those are wrong from a Christian point of view.
So does it have a spiritual implication? You know, sometimes it's said that it's demonic. They have a certain attachment. They realize they can't go on. They want to break up, but they can't because they have set that covenant.
It could be because, you know, there is no spiritual vacuum. So when you create spiritual symbolism, some spiritual entity must occupy it, you know, because you've created a spiritual space, some entity will occupy it. It's not going to be Jehovah God and His Holy Spirit. So some other spiritual entity will occupy because you've created a spiritual atmosphere. And that entity that occupies the spiritual entity will manipulate the relationship. But it's definitely not going to be God because He doesn't occupy that.
Doc, will you put prenuptial contracts in that same bracket of insecurity? Those who sign prenuptial...
Prenuptial, okay. I don't think it's a necessity. But normally it's for people who are very, very rich and feel that they are not trusting of the relationship they're going through. And they, some people have accepted divorce as a normal occurrence in marriage. And so people see marriage as a short-term contract. We're going to have fun for 12 years, and afterwards you'll go. And by the way, when you're going, don't take my money, don't take my property with me. So they sign that. But in a genuine Christian, God-centered, Christ-centered relationship, that's not how we go about it.
So, Doc, could all of this be born out of the overcommitment that you mentioned earlier?
Yes, I think it's all insecurity. If it's all insecurity, lack of trust for the other person. And let's face it, people have had very painful experiences. Some have lost everything through marriage or the dissolution of a marriage. And some have suffered very grievously and want to hedge against that. Or they've seen somebody suffer and want to hedge against it. I'm not in their shoes, and I'm not going to judge them for what they do. But what I can say is that from my understanding and from a Christian point of view, I don't see the place of it from my point of view.
Okay. Doc, there's a growing number of long-distance relationships. Sometimes the parties involved live and work in different countries, and it even travels in the marriage. How feasible is long-distance relationship?
Long-distance courtship can work. If you take the biblical account of Abraham sending his servant Eliezer to go and look for a wife for Isaac, that's a long-distance relationship. He went, procured the woman, and there was a long distance. So that's a kind of a long distance. I think if the relationship is long distance, but it will end with the two being together, I wouldn't be too worried about it. That means the long distance could be that maybe somebody's in school in another country, but by the time you want to marry, they would have finished their course and come back and they will be married. Or somebody is resident in another country, but when you marry, they would migrate to that country. If that's the idea, then I think a long distance courtship could work. The only thing is that there may be things you don't see about each other and which you see later when you are constantly in physical contact. That may make you probably wish that you had known each other physically. But beyond that, I think it has a possibility it could work.
What if it travels in the marriage? Maybe they courted long the
If it is just the first couple of years in the marriage whilst you're trying to resolve the problem, I think it can work. But when there's no attempt to resolve it and you want it to be the status quo, it will create problems for the marriage.
Talking about people who are courting for a long time and the only reason is because they are saving towards their big day. How important is the finances required to do a marriage compared to the actual marriage itself?
It's a very tricky question because part of marriage's commitment is financial. We spend money when we're married, especially when the kids come. So spending money is part of marriage. So the whole process of a couple saying, we're going to have a wedding, it cost us so much, and this is how we're going to resolve the marriage, and this is how we're going to manage the planning. It's part of the process of deepening your relationship to know how to manage a financial budget, manage expectations, organize and arrange for things to happen. So I don't want people to see just what happens as a waste of time for the marriage. I think when we do that, we are minimizing the learning process that we go through. Because most couples would say that probably the planning of their wedding was when they came together the closest, prayed together, sought God's face, planned together, and all of that. They became a project team to have a wedding. Yes, the wedding may just be for a few minutes, and that's the end. But the lessons learned in arriving at those few minutes are very, very, very useful for how you manage other projects in your marriage. Because one day you want to build a house or buy a house, you want to, and all these things, you have to plan it. So I think it's there. However, having said that, we should not make having a glamorous ceremony a most important part of our celebration. Neither should we also cheapen the union so much that we don't invest anything into it at all. I think that would be an expression of your own value of the relationship. If you think you shouldn't spend anything for it, then what are you going to spend money for? The union that brought you together, you're not ready to spend for. What are you ready to spend money for? Then when you have children, you say, well, they can go to any school. If your wife is going to have a child, you can say, oh, just anywhere is okay. Having a child on the floor is okay. No, that's not how we make decisions. Sometimes we pick up challenges and solve them. So I am not for the mindset that says the wedding is nothing. It is something. It's a project that a couple are working on. However, you must pick a project that is within your scope to manage. So it may not be very glamorous, but you have to do the right thing. You need to spend some money.
I think that what you said is the bottom line. Within your scope, within your means, yeah. But not to ravish it.
Yes. I know people who say the wedding ring is not important, and so they wouldn't spend any money on it. Yes, the wedding ring is not the marriage. But you see, where your treasure is, there your heart is. Things that you're ready to spend money on should show what you value. You know, so that's how I see it. So if you're going to get a wedding ring, don't spend all your money on it, but don't also cheapen it and things like that. So when it comes to wedding preparation, look at what is within your means and make it look good for the two of you. Honor yourselves. Honor yourself. It's your day, and honor the day.
This has been time with Pastor Otabo, and this is the part of the program that I like the least, when we have to wrap up on such a wonderful conversation. Doc, I want to say a big thank you to you. Your answers are always thought-provoking and unexpected in a lot of instances, but thank you so much for the perspectives that you've brought to today's discussion.
Thank you. Thank you.
And let me recommend to you, listeners and viewers, watch this episode over and over and recommend it to your loved ones, because there's so much that will be a blessing to you. Pastor Koyo, thank you for your contribution.
You're welcome.
Haven't you enjoyed this?
I have.
Tremendously. Pastor Priscilla?
It's been awesome.
Wonderful. Next week is the big one on marriage. Don't miss that one. Pastor, before we sign off, for the benefit of all those watching us, especially on the issue of being fruitful in premarital relationships, what would you sign off with? And then also a prayer for our viewers.
For all the young men and women, singles, who are working their way to marriage, I hope that the foundation of respect for each other will be established. Don't talk too harshly to each other. Don't abuse each other. Don't mistreat each other. Be patient, listen, take time, value their time, and let them be important to you. And don't do anything to your partner that diminishes them in your own sight. And when we build the culture of respect, we're building the right foundation for our marriage. So I pray for you, and I pray that God will touch your heart and God will touch your emotions and help you to feel secure in Him, so secure in Him that you are able to give of yourself to your partner. And may the Lord help you to build the right foundations in your marriage. And when you marry, may God give you a marriage that is heaven on earth.
Amen.
And may the Lord cause your days on earth to be full of joy, full of happiness, full of significance. In Jesus' name, amen.